Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
This episode of EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. Are you building a business? Achieving compliance with frameworks like ISO 27001 and SOC 2 can help you win bigger deals, enter new markets, and deepen trust with customers. But this can also cost you real time and money. Vanta automates up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand frameworks, helping businesses get compliant quickly. And with over 300 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your businesses rely on. Join over 7,000 fast-growing companies that use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. To learn more about how Vanta works and to get 20% off, visit vanta.com/EU Startups. That's vanta.com/EU Startups. Now, kick back and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My guest today is Sabina Wiesander, a partner at Creandum, one of the best venture capital funds in Europe. Sabina, congrats and how are you feeling today?
Thank you. Well, after that intro, I can't feel anything but great. Thank you so much for the kind words. Yeah, I mean, we're very excited. Of course, once you announce a fund, it's been in the making for quite some time. But this was a perfect timing. I think we will, you know, we'll start investing from the new fund in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great market to have more capital in. A lot of great companies fundraising right now. So I'm excited.
Awesome to hear that. Sabina, I know that you've had quite a journey from, you know, math-loving kid building stuff to a partner at Creandum. What was the most unexpected twist in your career that you never saw coming?
Unexpected twist. So, I mean, sometimes when younger people ask me, you know, how I plan my career to get where I wanted, etc. I mean, I have the disappointing answer that I never planned my career. At each point in time, I've looked at, you know, what looks like very exciting opportunities where I can have a lot of impact, and I went that direction. And, you know, looking at it now, it looks very unexpected, right? You go from McKinsey to VC to startup, etc. But I think, you know, the most unexpected twist is probably the beginning of my career, because I mean, as you said, I was always a person who loved math. I did, you know, master in engineering with a math focus, and I thought I was going to stay in academia to do a PhD in math. And it was just, you know, realizing that the hallways of math departments in the world wouldn't feed my craving for external thinking and external input on, you know, how I do things, and not be the kind of social environment that I needed to thrive, that I was left, I wouldn't say without options, but without visions of what I was going to do with my life. And I went to a technical university in the south of Sweden. It's quite far away from Stockholm, where all the big firms and, you know, consulting and the financial industry is. And I was quite far away from, I was not the kind of student that had my resume all written out year one, because I thought I was going to stay in academia, and you don't really need those things. And I had met McKinsey kind of first week of engineering school, for when they, you know, they invite, you know, they buy everyone sushi and they have a lunch presentation. And I had looked at those people and I said, wow, I will never work there. This one thing I know, I will never work there. So I guess the unexpected twist is, you know, still getting convinced that that was a firm for me. And of course, in the end, I mean, I loved, you know, almost every second of being there. You know, it was an amazing place, but it was, you know, would you have asked me a year prior to joining McKinsey that I would do that, I would say over my dead body.
Sounds good, Sabina. So actually, your journey took a turn from, as you already explained, from academia to consulting and then to the vibrant tech scene in San Francisco. What was kind of the defining moment that made you realize tech was, you know, your true calling.
Yeah. So I had the luxury of getting transferred to the San Francisco office with McKinsey. And that's, of course, uh-huh. you know, a place you want to, or a place I wanted to be. And I had worked on a couple of projects that was touching the tech industry. And we had the luxury of having some, you know, big names from tech as advisors on our project. So Eric mm-hmm. Schmidt was working with us closely on one of the things nice. we were working on. So, I mean, just being in San Francisco, this was 2012-13. So it was the time where a lot of the companies that are still, you know, the biggest companies in the world had yeah. just gotten big, right? So you were surrounded by, you know, new scale-ups that was just, mm-hmm. you know, eating and changing the world. But yeah. I think, you know, it sounds very cliche, and there's a lot of both positive and negative to say about Uber as a company. But ordering a cab in the US before that, and uh-huh. when I moved to the US, it was still calling and then waiting 15-20 minutes to go yeah. anywhere. And as a consultant, you go a lot with cabs everywhere. Uh-huh. So, you know, downloading the Uber app and stepping into that car for the first mm-hmm. time, I had that kind of Uber experience that every right. startup is looking for with the consumer or with the user, right? That's like, oh, wow. Of course, you know, it feels so obvious, right? When someone yeah. has sold something in a beautiful way, it feels very obvious that that's the way it should work. And it was a very powerful moment, to be honest.
Awesome. I love it. So Sabina, at Creandum, you've supported some incredible founders. You know, can you share a story where a founder's vision blew you away for the first time?
I mean, I think the luxury of being a VC is, I mean, it's a daily thing that someone comes in and, you know, they spent a couple of years, you know, working on like the vision of how they can change the world. And they're here for, you know, 30, 45, 60 minutes to tell me about what the future looks like in an industry. And I love that. That's the best part of my job. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, looking at, you know, one of the first early things that just, you know, kind of shook me, and this, you know, this will, you know, sound very obvious, was I had lunch with Johannes Schildt, the CEO of Cree, uh-huh. you know, a couple of months before we invested. And I had already spent a lot of time in the industry of digital health. We were very close to investing in a couple of the other players in Europe, but mm-hmm. because, you know, we had this thesis that, you know, digital is happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is an area where it hasn't happened yet, mm-hmm. and it will happen. You just need the right, you know, crazy person to take on this very, very old-fashioned, slow-moving, conservative yeah. industry. And having lunch with Johannes, when Cree was one of the smallest players, actually, they were far behind Mean Doctor and a couple of the other players on the forefront back then. I felt very strongly I could not invest in anything that was competing against this guy. That was the feeling coming from that lunch. You know, he just, you know, sold me the vision of what healthcare should look like when the patient is in yeah. the center of the experience. But I think, you know, already back then, I think he was trying to recruit me. And I think that's the way he operates, right? He speaks to someone that buys into his vision, and he uh-huh. he identifies that. And he says, why don't you join my tribe, right?
Yeah.
But that was one of those, right? Like, this is exactly, you know, but this, and I mean, it took way longer for me to mm-hmm. to join them as an operator. But I think, you know, in order to be an entrepreneur and to change an industry the way it's been operating for, you know, decades or centuries, and to do that successfully, yeah. you need the right type of like obsessive, slightly crazy, but of yeah. course, like genius founder to be able to do that.
100%. That's actually, we are nicely, like smoothly transitioning to the next question, because this is actually going to be about Cree. And first and foremost, I want to say that good that you talked about it before me because I was about to pronounce them. Cry. Now I know it's Cree.
You're not the first one.
Yeah. So your time there, you know, sounds like a like it was like a wild ride. What's the most valuable lesson you learned about, you know, the difference between being an investor and being an operator?
Yeah, I think, you know, being in a VC investor and being an operator in a tech startup, it sounds like two jobs that are very close to each other, and they are, but they're quite different in, you know, what you do, what you spend your time thinking about.
Yeah.
But I do think that a lot of value that I brought into Cree came from having been on the VC side before. And I think now, as the VC industry has grown and, you know, European entrepreneurs has adopted the habits of recruiting chiefs of staffs or founder mm-hmm. associates, it's more common to take, you know, young people from VC into positions into startups. But I do think what you have as an investor is you think about the company first and foremost. You don't think about your own KPIs. You don't think about your own performance. All you think about is how does this become a successful company? Yeah. And I think that's a strength, and not every operator is thinking that way, putting the company first. But you might be leading, you know, the product side, and you think about the, you know, product first, for example. So I think coming in and thinking like an owner of the company, even though you aren't as a new operator coming in, I think is really valuable for the company and for the founders, because, you know, otherwise they are going to be the only ones that's going to be sleepless about, you know, the company perspective, and everyone else is just going to be sleepless around smaller topics. But I had the luxury of now having transitioned from investor to startup and back again, and also while being an operator, being on a couple of boards, so doing the roles simultaneously. And I think I wish more, I mean, I think it's getting more and more common in Europe that investors come from the operating side. I think that's a great thing. I think the lesson as an operator is that even if your business model is so complex that your investor might not even realize exactly how it works, and they might not be in the details, I think someone coming in with that helicopter perspective is something you should listen to. Should you do exactly as your investors say? No, I'm not suggesting that. But I do think there's more value than a lot of operators and founders see, because someone is always looking at the more long-term perspective, and someone's always looking at kind of, you know, things from 10,000 feet. And when your operator's so busy, you know, you're thinking day to day and week to week progress, that it's good to be forced back up. But then, of course, as an investor, I think, you know, it's so easy to simplify things, right? Everything looks so easy in terms of decisions. Like, why don't you just replace your CTO? Or why don't you just close the French market? Because it looks like obvious decisions, but actually the operational complexity around changing a C-level person, or the operational complexity of, and the costs of just shutting down a market where there might still be opportunity, is there, right? So I think it's, you know, from the operator side, it's always, there is a strong point on the like simplicity in the decisions that are coming from the board. But from the board, I think it's good to have a little bit of, to be a bit humble in that it's not as clear as it looks like in the board deck, right? When you're in it from the operating side. And I mean, I've said this before. I think if I had, you know, because I've always also been part of the fundraising processes at Cree from kind of the when we took in Accel back in, I think was the, you know, a big A round.
Yeah.
If I would have gone back to being an investor only after 6 months on the operating side and having seen like the other side of the table in a fundraising process, I think I would have been, you know, 10x better investor. Just, you know, having a bit more understanding of what it looks like from the other side. What does it look like when you get a question list of 25 random questions that, mm-hmm. you know, some associate had just put together with very little thought into, mm-hmm. is this actually what we need answers to? Or will I just create a lot of work uh-huh. for whoever is on the receiving end of this list?
So feeling a bit like, so understanding the founder better, actually, my next question to you was a bit about, you know, that now that you're back in the investor seat, how has your hands-on experience at Cree changed your approach to working with founders? And you you answered that a bit already, but maybe you want to elaborate a bit more.
I think you
have like more empathy for founders, and you know how it looks from the other side. So you can maybe like relate to different challenges and situations a bit more.
I mean, I think I do, and I mean, I've seen the inside of a startup that scales from, you know, 10 to 1,000 people, that scales from, you know, 1 to 150 million in revenues. Of course, you know, you've seen a lot of different phases of company building where you can bring in examples from, you know, your own past when you speak to founders. But I have a lot of respect for every journey looks different and every startup is different, right? But I do think that there's a lot of cliches that are true, like talent is everything and it's all about the, you know, betting on the right founder. Uh-huh. And all those truths, I think both as an investor and operator, you have to kind of live through them to really feel how true they are, right?
Yeah.
And I think having seen how tough it is to scale startup from, you know, seed to unicorn from the inside, I think it just puts more emphasis on like what kind of person, you know, need to run this.
Yeah,
you know, they need to be obsessed with this mission, right? This is not a job, this is the mission of their life. This is the sole purpose of what they're doing. And it sounds very extreme, but it is very extreme scale a startup to a $1 billion company, right? It's not for everyone. So I think it's just, you know, giving me, you know, a bit more nuance into like what do you actually need to look for. I think I'm an ex-management consultant, I'm an ex-engineer, I like structure, but I think a learning is that if you're going to do something at a high pace, which you need to do if you're a venture-backed business, you need to have a high acceptance for chaos.
Right.
And when I look at companies, I have a high acceptance for, you know, how chaotic things are, as long as you're focusing on like, you know, the right big things. If you're winning the right battles, it's fine if you don't have a perfect HR system. Actually, maybe it's the right decision that you just have a random piece of paper that where you have everyone's name and phone number on, right? I think it's when some founders are very early on obsessing about, you know, internal processes and structures, that kind of puts me off, because that's not the right, you know, then you're spending too much time winning the wrong battles in the early stage company building.
Gotcha. Sabina, so you've seen the challenges founders face firsthand, and you've built a reputation for, you know, supporting founders with empathy and no sugarcoating. What's the toughest moment you've experienced along the way, and how did it turn out? And what's, you know, like kind of a one piece of advice you wish you had back then?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I think in even the best company journeys, even the most successful companies, there is a lot of ups and downs. And I think that's what you need to prepare founders for. Like, it's not a bad company, it's a bad month. Or it's not a, you know, we're not driving off a cliff, we have a tough quarter. In, you know, looking, I haven't been on the inside of Spotify, but speaking of with people who have, now that's their experience as well. There's, it's never going to look like 100% success, right? That's not the path to building a large company. But I do think that, I mean, I'm very pleased to hear that I have a reputation of not sugarcoating it, because I think it's very much my style of, I think as an investor and advisor, you have the responsibility to, you know, be transparent with your founders. You know, you're not a cheerleader, but you're on the same team as them. So you're on the same team. You should be able to afford, the relationship should be able to afford for you to say, it doesn't look very promising going into this fundraise, right? Like, there are a couple of things we need to solve then. How can we work together to solve those to make sure that we can fund the company again, right? But I do think, I mean, the tough things as an investor is, of course, when, you know, you need, you have a, you know, in order to be a successful VC, you need to, you know, make the right bets. You need to invest in successful companies. And then whoever turns out to be the more successful ones, that's where you put more money in.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you also want to support the companies that can't fundraise. And but that's not the business you're in, right? You're not in the business of deploying more capital into companies that are not taking off. And I mean, I've had the luxury so far in, you know, going from times where I had these tough conversations with founders, like, this is going to be a tough fundraise. You know, let's be honest with that, and let's work together to build, you know, a long enough Rolodex so you can become very successful anyway, so we get the work done. But I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. I'm not going to say, you know, it's going to be a walk in the park. You do, you know, you do your magic and the money will come, right? Like, let's prepare for this to take a couple of months. And so far, I've had, you know, good turnouts in those situations anyways, which is fortunate. But it's always tough when you tell your founders that, you know, if the money doesn't come in, we're not going to bail you out as a fund. But I do think it's important to be frank with that, right? To for the founder to have the perspective that I can't half-ass this, because, you know, I don't have the support from my current investor collective.
Sabina, so speaking about fundraising, Creatom just rolled out a 500 million euro fund that was oversubscribed with some of the world's greatest investors as LPs. So can you share a bit of behind the scenes with us? How do you actually get the world's leading investors as LPs?
Yeah, it's easy. You just do step 1, 2, 3, and then
the exactly. No, I was hoping for this kind of answer.
No, I think Creatom's been around for 20 years, and many of these years have been very successful. I obviously haven't been part of the firm for all those 20 years, so I feel very fortunate to have had the luxury of not once but twice, you know, join a very, very successful firm. But I do think, I mean, one of the things that I noticed doing my due diligence on Creatom when I was considering coming back to the firm was that all the things that, you know, we had said we would do back in 2016, we said, you know, we'll open a Berlin office, then after that we will go to London, you know, we'll raise these funds and we'll have this kind of exit opportunities. I came back and I looked at the company from outside in during 2021 when I was interviewing to come back. Yeah. And they had done all these things. And that sounds very obvious. You know, you tell your investors, this is what we will do, and you do it. But I mean, we're in the startup industry. We know that, you know, often you tell your investors you're going to do 5 things, and if you do 3, that's very good, right?
Yeah.
But I do think there's something about, you know, setting high goals and then, you know, over and over and over again, showing that you can deliver on 100% of what you say you will deliver on. And I think that's both operational in terms of this is how we want to build the firm. But of course, it's, you know, in the end, it's about results and returns. And, you know, we've been, you know, quite secretive about our returns up until very recently. But I think if you look at all the funds, you know, up until, you know, the last one we're investing from, and looking at the last rounds of the underlying startups, it's somewhere between, I think, 5 and 13x on invested capital. So, of course, if you keep delivering that fund after fund after fund, that becomes very attractive to to the underlying capital.
Amazing. So with half of the capital for Fund 7 coming from US investors, how do you see the relationship between European startups and US investors evolving in the next few years?
I think, I mean, we have, I think, 5 out of the 8 biggest endowments in the US coming into the Creandum funds. So obviously that's a strong testament to them believing in Europe being able to continue to deliver fantastic companies, high value outcomes, and therefore great multiples to them. I mean, they have access to some of the best fund managers in the world, and they choose to place large part in European fund managers, which I think is saying something about their belief in the European tech ecosystem. I do, however, think that, I mean, what we are seeing on our level of the industry and our peers is, of course, that the big surge of US VCs that came in to Europe post the pandemic, that is kind of moving back a little, right? I think we do see that a couple of, you know, very top tier names are shutting down the local shop in London and are covering Europe from the US again. So going back to kind of their 2019 setup. And I do also think that, you know, while they're some of the most successful VCs in the world, some of them might have underestimated the fragmentation in the European market and how you are successful in this side of the world. So I'm, you know, we think we're competing on a global level, you know, of when it comes to the best entrepreneurs. But we do see that if anything, the US investors are pulling, you know, back from Europe when it comes to direct VC investments, or doing it from the other side of the pond.
Sabina, I've really been enjoying having this conversation with you. This is going to be the last part of it, unfortunately. Let's flip the script a bit. And let me ask you this. What's the one thing that sets Creandum apart as the perfect partner for visionary entrepreneurs? So this is your time to actually pitch Creandum to founders. How would your pitch sound?
Yeah, how does my pitch sound? I think it very much reflects on, you know, I've seen the other side of many successful VCs in Europe. I mean, we had the luxury of working with some of the best people from Accel, Index, Project A, Creandum, and a couple of growth funds. And I think, you know, when I speak to entrepreneurs, I try to be, you know, not pitching them, but just be very open and frank about how I would pick and why I chose to go back to Creandum, why I think it's a good choice. I do think that, you know, we are a team of former operators, and I think that shows. I think it shows in that, you know, we've been on the side of the table where you have to bleed and sweat every day to roll the stone up the hill and build the startup. And I think that shows in our experience, but I think it also shows in how we deal with you know, when things are tough in startups, that we can still be on the side of the entrepreneur. And when I took references on Creandum coming back, I spoke to a handful of entrepreneurs that had been backed by Creandum, both successful and unsuccessful ones. And the one thing that stood out was, you know, in bad times, Creandum's been the only one that really had my back. And even, you know, founders that had completely failed with their companies, they still said, you know, I felt by coming into the Creandum office, they're not only the partner that led the deal on my side, but everyone was patting me on my back and said, you know, well done. You know, it doesn't always turn out the way you wanted, but truly feeling supported in not only the ups, because it's easy to have supporters in ups, but also having supporters in tough times, which, you know, there will be tough times if you're building a billion-dollar company. And I also think now as, you know, the world is, yes, becoming more flat, but, you know, the one thing you can truly get from your VC is the Rolodex and their network. Mm-hmm. And we have a very spread out approach. We're spread out across Stockholm, Berlin, London, and San Francisco, which for us is, of course, a pain. We don't sit next to our dear colleagues every day. Yeah. But for the entrepreneurs we serve, we open up not only, you know, one ecosystem, one network, but we open up networks of talent in all these hubs. And we can connect, you know, I think the very common setup nowadays is you build your commercial team in the US and you keep your tech team on European soil. And I, you know, we have probably a dozen of companies with that setup because we've been in the US for a long time. We know how to support founders. Having a truly global team setup. But then I think also in the end, you know, you can pick you can pick an investor that is doing 10 deals per year, or you can pick an investor that is doing 1 to 2 deals per year, which we do here. And it will have a fundamental impact on how much you can utilize your VC firm, how much airtime you get, and just what, you know, what kind of headspace, you know, your company will take up for that, for that, you know, person you bring on as an advisor.
Sounds awesome, Sabina. That was way more than 1 minute. So,
sorry about that.
That's amazing. I really love the conversation, Sabina. I love having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time and telling us more about yourself and about Creandum. I wish you all the best, and I can't wait to see what's going to be your next investment.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Awesome. Bye.